So I plan to give an overview of global geometric Langlands conjecture from mathematical point of view. So I'll just actually see this. Did I pick the worst possible piece of chalk? And my goal is pretty much just to introduce the main players, maybe fix the notation. So I expect that at least half of you will be bored, probably the other half will be confused. So, but let's, so I think that's probably as good a result as I can hope for. All right, so let me start with, making some kind of precise, semi-precise statement, and then I'll try to add more properties, add more players into it. So first, the input, which, so the data that I need to start with is, first I need to fix a field, and I'll always work over C. So there's a Riemann surface in place. And a reductive group. And I'll also need its dual, which I'll denote by G check. So. All right. And in fact, for parts of the talk, I will assume that, so sometimes it's really nice to assume that G is GLN. In fact, we might as well assume that G is GL2. Sometimes it will make things too simple. Well, we'll see. So there are two main spaces. Maybe I should put them low on the board. So the two main spaces involved are the space of G bundles, principal G bundles, on this Riemann surface, and the space of local systems, G-check local systems. And, okay, and I say a space, but in reality they are both algebraic stacks. For example, I guess one point I want to make about the first space is that there are no stability conditions or anything of this kind. And for the second space, when I say local systems, I actually mean bundles with connections. So this is G-check bundle with connection. And so, in particular, I want to say that it doesn't really depend on the complex structure of X, but it's not quite true, because those are actually, so to say, algebraic local systems rather than just representations of the fundamental group. More precisely, I can think of this analytically. Analytically, this is the same as just representations of the fundamental homomorphisms from the fundamental group of X to G check. But I need to work with this algebraically, and because it's not compact, these two actually have different algebraic structures, and so it's important to keep this in mind. Okay, and so roughly speaking, the conjecture, so the global, maybe I should just keep the title, the global geometric Langlands correspondence is approximately the statement that there is an equivalence between the category of D modules on G bundles and the category of quasi-coherent sheaves on G-check local systems. So I'm going to write this even though that's manifestly false, and that's why this approximate sign here. So, but at least this gives me a chance to discuss more notation. So when I say D modules, this is the derived category of D modules. So in other words, quasi-coherent sheaves. So I guess infinite dimensional vector bundles. Well, quasi-coherent sheaves on bund G with flat connection. And on the right, there's also this implicit derived the word derived is always assumed. So it's the derived category of quasi-coherent sheaves. All right, so far so good. By the way, please don't hesitate to stop me at any point, if anything. I mean, the whole point here is to lay foundations for something, so we want to make sure it's actually somewhat solid. All right, and so as I said, this is true only approximately. In fact, I have to, the right-hand side needs an enlargement, and so this is not going to work. So precise statement, or precise conjecture, is need to enlarge the right-hand side by taking Arthur parameters into account. And I don't want to discuss, I just don't have time to go into details, but I can just say that generally speaking, this enlargement is non-trivial because the stack of local systems is not smooth. So this exists, so this is necessary because this stack is singular. And this there is a precise way to measure this singularity, which I will denote it kind of cryptically as the shifted cotangent bundle of this stack. But in reality, this just consists of pairs, a local system, and an infinitesimal infinitesimal symmetry of this local system. So it will consist of a pair, L, a local system, and A is the infinitesimal symmetry of this local system. And so if you like, you can think, well, it's kind of implicit in this notation, that this is actually fibered over the stack of local systems. If you have if you picked some generic local system, then it won't have any infinitesimal symmetries, well, at least if the group is semi-simple. And so you will just get zero, but for some special ones, and those are, for some special ones, you have other choices for A. And then the claim, or there is a construction that I'm just using as a black box here. So there's a certain construction that can associate to a conical subset in this, for any conical subset in this space, we can get a certain category. And if we start with the... I don't know, should I actually write this slow? I cannot tell.
That's a little bit too low.
Okay.
Try not to go below where you were.
All right. So that's also probably better for my back. And, so anyway, so so there is a construction where starting from any conical subset, so I can, from a conical subset, I can go to a category, which is some kind of some version of the category on the right-hand side, some version of this category of quasi-coherent sheaves. And in particular, if I consider, if I require that this infinitesimal symmetry is zero, then I'm just going to get the category itself, the original category. If I don't impose any conditions, so let's say any A, then I will get something called the category of incoherent sheaves, which turns out to be too big to fit on the right-hand side of the geometric Langlands correspondence. And the, at least conjecturally, the conjecturally correct answer is to require that this infinitesimal symmetry is nilpotent. So A is nilpotent. And this is the category that we like.
Sorry, something? Yes. When you say you need to enlarge the right-hand side, mm-hmm. Does it mean, well, there's a good reason?
Yes.
Well, I don't know, certainly there's a good reason, but... So are you going to explain us what you're missing? So
right.
Models, we want to now include?
Right. So, well, I mean, obviously, as stated now, it's very hard to say anything because I didn't impose any conditions on this. I will say a little bit about this later. There are natural ways to, well, there are natural things on the left that's supposed to match to certain things on the right. And roughly what happens is that, I'm trying to give an answer that doesn't sound as a formal, formal objection, but let me make a formal objection and then tell you why I care. So somehow the formal objection is that both of those categories, so to say, maybe I can say it like this, that both of them have a basis, but somehow some vectors that are supposed to be basis vectors on the left turn out to be linearly dependent on the right. So precise way of saying it is that both of those categories are compactly generated, so they have nice compact objects on the left and on the right. And then there are these compatibility conditions, and these compatibility conditions tell you that certain compact objects on the left are supposed to correspond to some things that are not compact on the right. And so this enlargement basically can be thought of as making things that were non-compact compact. So it's like, I guess you can also argue that if you have a bunch of linearly dependent vectors in a vector space, you can just take the category, you can just consider the vector space where they form a basis. So this enlargement, I guess you can think of it, on the one hand, it's good to think of this category as containing this one, but sometimes it also helps to think about it as lying over it by means of some kind of projection. Yes.
It should look some simple module on the left, something like all, Does it land? Where does it land?
Well, where does O land? That's the answer. I think is that that's not a simple demo. Somehow, yes. So somehow the problem is that For example, these basis objects, they are actually some, somehow, let me say that we just discussed, or kind of discussed, that the difficulty on the right-hand side stems from singularities. The difficulty on the left-hand side stems from non-compactness, that exactly because there's no semi-stability conditions anywhere, this stack is not covered by a single prism. So the more understandable objects here, the compact objects, are actually those that start on some open set, and on a big open set, and then you just extend them by zero from there. And so then they don't look like local systems. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can...
I was wondering, somehow, this thing on the right-hand side has to do with missing numpoles or... for Neumann, yeah.
Hey. Yes.
There was this question, what does the constant D-module correspond to, right?
Yes.
The zero D-module, right?
Is it that?
Yeah, the one with zero connection of.
Correct. The answer can be given, and I think, let's talk about it in the discussion session. You can write an explicit formula. It's a very fun formula. It's kind of, it's this phantom Whittaker thing on the coherent mm-hmm. side.
Right. But anyway, but somehow I think the point is that it's easier to say what vector bundles on the right correspond to, but those are going to be exactly D modules that see that are very kind of compactly supported. Well, not really compactly supported, but they're supported on something very on a small piece of this. Other questions? All right. All right, so now I should, as I said, this is the category that I want, and so now I can give a precise statement of the conjecture. Let me actually close this out. So the precise statement of the conjecture is that the actual conjecture is that there's an equivalence between this category and the category of D modules on bond G. Satisfying some properties that we haven't discussed yet. And I'll need names for these two sides at some point. So I'm going to call this one the automorphic side. And this is the Galois side. So really, I mean, A stands for automorphic, B stands for Galois, I guess. So, all right. Now, the somehow the first, so if there are no questions, let's talk about compatibility conditions that this must satisfy. And so the first and the maybe more familiar one, I don't know why I jumped to three. Because I'm skipping something from my notes. So there's compatibility using the Hecke functors and or and so namely given. And again, I'll just discuss the general setup. So given any point on the Riemann surface and any representation of the Langlands dual group, we can define two pieces of data. So we can define a functor from the category of D modules to itself. Which is, in essence, corresponds to the fact that we can take a G bundle and change it, modify it slightly at the point X. So we have this Hecke functor, and secondly, there's also a vector bundle. I don't know if I should call it a Wilson vector bundle, So this is, I guess, a toothed operator then. So I'll call it E for evaluation. So the Wilson vector bundle XV vector bundle on this stack of local systems. And for example, I'm getting dangerously close to the cutoff. I guess example. By the way, what are my limits, kind of right to left? Should I use that board? Is there some natural point? No. Some people said no, too late. So, okay, what about this board? I started here. Again, this is already in use, so it's like. Okay, so. So for example, when G is GL2, it's particularly easy, and well, when G is GL2, and V is the standard representation of the Langlands dual group, which happens to be GL2 as well, we have the following explicit description. So let me describe the functor first. So there is the functor will be described geometrically by pulling back and pushing forward along certain diagram. We call this pi1 and pi2. And so in this diagram, we have the. So this diagram is defined by looking at space of simplest possible modifications of a vector bundle at the point x. So here we consider pairs of vector bundles. So E1 and E2 are rank 2 bundles on X, and they are related by a map that fails to be an isomorphism, but only at the point X, and only in the simplest possible way. So phi is a rational isomorphism, and whose determinant has a simple zero at X. Simple zero X. So this is an explicit description of this space, and it comes with two projections that I denoted by pi1 and pi2, that simply each of them remembers just one of the vector bundles. So this is the. So this is the space, and then the Hecke functor. Did I write XVVX? Not that it matters. Is defined by taking pull back and push forward along this diagram. So in other words, in down to earth terms, if we think of D modules as some kind of functions, then we want to say that the value of the transformed function at a particular vector bundle is obtained by integrating over all vector bundles that differ from it in this simplest way at one point only. Okay, so this is the.
You're integrating over all parameters measuring the difference between the vector bundles.
Yes, so in particular, this means that if it so happens that for many different modifications they get isomorphic vector bundles, it has to come with multiplicity. So Since this is, by the way, since this is GL2, you can actually see that this is actually integral over P1. So this is, so I mean, there are vector bundles involved, but somehow the idea, and this will keep popping up in the discussion of conjecture, is that of the geometric Langlands conjecture, is that some things, the parts of it that are more easily understood tend to be local. So here, we are working with vector bundles, but what we do happens only at a point x. And similarly, on the right-hand side, the vector bundle that I promised is just also defined using this point only. So this is the vector bundle on the stack of local systems whose fiber over a particular local system is just this kind of tautological vector bundle. So if you have a local system, it's a vector bundle with connection. In particular, you can take its fiber at the point x. And now what we consider this, we consider how this depends on the local system L. All right. And so now that I define this, well, I didn't define them in general, but at least now that we discussed them in one example, I can add to this conjecture. I don't need this part anymore. That's the only one I'm going to be interested in for now. I can add to this conjecture an important compatibility property, namely, I claim that we require that the action of the Hecke functor corresponding to this x and v on the left-hand side is supposed to go to the functor of twist by this vector bundle on the right-hand side. You know what I meant. Yeah, for some reason, in my notes, they are actually reversed. And here, just because of the way the blackboard flows, they ended up on their own sides. Should be easy enough to fix. Anything else? All right, notice, by the way, that there are some particularly nice objects here, and this is classically, this is how the story started, is that if I take any point in the stack of local systems, then I can consider just a one-dimensional space sitting at that particular point. Well, technically, if I want to work with this because of this modification, I would be much happier if instead of taking any point, we take a local system, we take a point corresponding to an irreducible local system. So let me continue.
How is that related to the modification?
It's related to the modification that that the structure sheaf sitting at an irreducible local system will be compact object. Here, it's also compact. It's also compact in the original one, but if I take arbitrary point, it's not going to be compact. So it's not clear that that's such a great object to consider here. So,
when are the objects labeled by an SHU representation and?
Labeled just by, no, I'm talking about an object layer, so sorry, the question came before I had a chance to write anything on the board, so let me write and then I can just point. So, right, so the claim is that part of this So what's built into this compatibility is, so a special case of the compatibility is that if I take a point in this space, that is to say a local system, so take L, a local system in G-check, and as I said, because I'm kind of too scared of non-compact objects, at least at this moment, I will assume that it's irreducible. Then, to this irreducible local system, I can associate just as, so to say, a skyscraper sheaf sitting at that one point. And if I believe in this, the condition that I imposed on this correspondence, by the way, I'll need some notation for it. I'll denote it by some kind of very bold L, so blackboard bold L. So I can see that the corresponding D module on bond G has to be very special. Namely, I mean, what's special about a sheaf sitting at one point is that when we tensor it by a vector bundle, it's going to be essentially a direct sum of copies of itself. Because even if the vector bundle is not trivial, it's trivial at that particular point. And so what we expect is that because of this, so we can say that the object on the left-hand side is an eigenobject for this Wilson operators, and so its image on the right-hand side should be an eigensheaf for Hecke functors. So the compatibility, so compatibility implies that this sheaf should be an eigen D module, I guess I should be technically saying, but just eigenvector in some fancy, not quite vector space. So eigen D module for the action of the Hecke functors. And then, of course, again, I'm only saying this some very simple version of this. In reality, you should also say that you can also read off the eigenvalues of these Hecke functors, and they're encoded by the corresponding local system. So one way to think about this conjecture is that, that it's supposed to send the basis of maybe I should just say that it looks a little bit like the Fourier transform, where the object on the left-hand side parameterizes common eigenvectors of a family of Hecke functors on the left-hand side. Questions?
Are you going to describe things involving an SL2 embedding?
Things involving what?
An SL2 embedding in a local system commuting with that?
No. So, I mean, here I'm not really describing things. I'm saying that this has to have certain property, but I'm not saying, for instance, which Hecke eigenfunctor it should be. So what I want to say is I want to discuss how to normalize this, and in the process also explain how to, hopefully, explain how to take care of non-trivial, of kind of non-zero Arthur parameters. But let me just say that there is a way to actually strengthen this statement, well, strengthen this compatibility requirement, by asking what happens, how much can you actually get out of those Hecke functors if you allow points to vary, if you allow these representations to vary, and moreover, what happens if you also allow points to fuse, and then the corresponding representations will will turn into the tensor project or something like this. And so the upgraded version of this Hecke functors. So this is an actual theorem, not a conjecture, is that Hecke functors can be glued, or maybe fused is a better word here, to first call it, this is a technically generalized vanishing theorem, but that's the only kind we'll have in this talk, is that all the Hecke functors taken together, they, let me use the word fuse, they determine an action of the category of quasi-coherent sheaves on local systems on the category of D modules on G bundles. And so the action in the sense that for every object here, there's a functor. And if I compose functors, this is the tensor product of objects on the left. In particular, the usual Hecke functors correspond to the action of this Wilson vector bundles on the left. And here it's really, I didn't make a mistake, I really mean the category of quasi-coherent sheaves, not its enlargement. So in other words, one way to think about it is that we have some kind of big algebra acting on both sides. Now, if the naive version of Langlands conjecture held, so if that was actually quasi-core here, then this would be a free rank one module over this algebra. And then, essentially, the conjecture would be almost completely determined. This correspondence would be almost completely determined by this vanishing theorem. We would just need to normalize it, say, which basis, like we could choose a generator on the left and tell you, pick its image on the right, and then everything would follow from there. Well, at least functor would follow. We would have to prove that the right-hand side is actually free mode. In reality, because of singularities of the stack of local systems, because of this enlargement, the situation is slightly more complicated. And that's why it's important to account not just for the zero Arthur parameter, but for all of them.
So there is not action of int core on itself?
No, it's the action of quasi-core on int core. So there's we can say that there is, in fact, there's an action of the same object on both sides, but it's quasi-core of local systems.
On the left-hand side, would it be possible to also have an action of int-core, or just the best tensor product work?
I mean, you can tensor them, but it's a little bit, I mean, the whole point is that if you tensor, so quasi-core is generated, compactly generated, I keep coming back to this compact generator, so it's compactly generated by perfect complexes, so basically vector bundles. And you take tensor product of two vector bundles, you get a vector bundle. You take tensor product of two coherent sheaves, they are not going to be flat, so you're going to immediately get some kind of infinite cohomological behavior. So there is a tensor product here, and I mean, normally they differ by a twist by the cotangent, by the canonical sheaf, but alas, this stack of local systems is symplectic, so that's not going to matter in this case. But it's not a very natural operation to consider. Well, it's more complicated.
Sorry, Dima?
Yes?
Can you explain why this Hecke functor is fused to an action of this thing?
Well, it's not a trivial theorem. I mean, I can say why it's called the vanishing theorem. Somehow, the point is that first you have to figure out, there is a tautological part of the fusion. You can ask, okay, so what actually naturally acts from these Hecke operators? And then you need to define some version. So you want to say that, yes, you can act by Hecke functors at individual points, and then if you have a family of points, you can weigh them by something. So in the result, you get an action of something called the run version of something that sits on the over the run space, so the run version of the category of G-check representations, of representations of G-check. And this is bigger than this. And so somehow the idea that you should have in mind is that you have a big algebra that kind of acts on the left tautologically. Oh, sorry, on the right. And the claim is to show that the action of this big algebra actually, that it acts through its quotient, which is this. So the vanishing that appears here, it's like the claim that if you have something that's in the kernel of the ideal that you need to mod out by to get this, that this object acts trivially, that the corresponding composition of Hecke operators acts as zero.
The big thing is the RAND version of the G-check representations.
The big thing is the RAND version of G-check representations, and this is its quotient.
Why is that a quotient?
Well, that's actually, I mean, we'll never get anywhere.
Okay.
But yeah, anyway, this is, so believe me that anything other than that statement is relatively built into definitions. So the hard part is the vanishing. Maybe that's an overkill. Okay. Anyway, so this can go. So and now the last part that I want to discuss is how to actually normalize this correspondence, and also this will also include the question of dealing with this non-zero Arthur parameters. So and again, even for usual Fourier transform, I guess, if the only thing you know about the exponential function is its differential equation, then you don't know, you need to decide how you scale it. So the way it works is that the category of D modules, so we need to do some kind of functional analysis on the category of D modules. And one way to think about it is that to any D module, we can associate its Fourier coefficients. So, in this language, I can say that there is some kind of correspondence, a functor from the category of D modules to the category of Fourier coefficients. And technically, these are going to be extended Whittaker coefficients. And let me just define them. Again, I'll just won't actually define anything. I'll define things by example. So let me say that G is, I think I wanted to take GL2 rather than SL2. So if G is GL2, then there are still many of those Fourier coefficients. But let me discuss the simplest one, or the simplest ones. So the simplest coefficients appear as follows. So there's in fact a natural map. Okay, I'm going lower. So in order to have Fourier coefficients, I want to take my function, or in this case, D module, and turn it into an object on a vector space. So there is a map I might denote it by psi from C to bound G. And the way this map is defined is I think of C as all possible extensions between two line bundles, well, O and omega, so that's the smallest case where there are non-trivial extensions. And then if I have an extension class, I can associate to it, to this extension, well, just a short exact sequence of vector bundles. And so this E is going to be now a G bundle. And so now if, for example, if I had a function on bound G, I could pull it back, get a function of one variable, and then take its Fourier transform. So for any, now I can do this for D modules instead of functions. So for any D module on bound G, we can consider the Fourier coefficients consider the Fourier coefficients of its pullback. Now, actually, because I don't look at this exact sequence itself, I only look at what sits in the middle. In fact, this alpha only matters up to scaling. So this map is kind of dilation invariant. So because psi is C star invariant, in fact, in some sense, there are only two meaningful coefficients. There's the zero coefficient and the non-zero coefficient. And that turns out to be an important fact. So it's important because it turns out that the two behave in a significantly different way under the conjectural Langlands correspondence. So because it's invariant, there are two. So the first coefficient, then now let me call it non-degenerate coefficient, let's see C1, which is, I guess I can think of it as the Dramka homology of, anyway, just the integral of this D module against the exponential, local system. So I'll pull it back, tensor it with the exponential system and integrate, which in this case means take the Dramka homology. And the degenerate one, where you do the same thing but without the twist. And somehow, once again, I should say that this, maybe I won't say it. So, the point that I want to make is that these two look very different on the right-hand side, so on the automorphic side. So the normalization built into this conjecture, so in other, I guess I just erased the word compatibility, now I have to just reconstruct it. So compatibility is that on the automorphic side, it's at least at first glance, it's this non-degenerate ones, the more complicated ones that look simpler. So this, in fact, this C1 just corresponds to taking globals. Yeah, it completely messed up my head that, you know, the board is a reflection of what's in my notes. So I have the functor C1 on the automorphic side. And that's So on the automorphic side, I have the functor C1. Now, on the Galois side, the correspondent functor just takes a quasi-coherent sheaf, or this int-coherent sheaf, and takes its global sections. So this C1 corresponds to the functor of global sections. And this is gamma of, gamma of local. And so, and somehow, I want to say that again, if we were in the simple world where you actually have quasi-core here, if this were, if this was a rank one free module over this algebra, then this action together with this would define everything completely. So on the left-hand side, I'm saying that if I know how to take, if I have a quasi-coherent sheaf, and I know how to take its global sections, and I also know how to take its global sections after tensoring by anything else, then I know the quasi-coherent sheaf completely. So, but because it's not a free module, it's good, there should be something extra, and that's what the constant, what this degenerate Whittaker coefficient takes care of, but in a very funny way. So this, the functor C0 on the right hand side, let me first, on the Galois side, corresponds to some kind of global sections functor, but only after a certain transform. So it corresponds, so to say, to global sections over a torus, or for local systems over a torus. Okay, I'm not saying more about this. I'll just write the diagram. So there's a natural relation between local systems for the reductive group and for its torus that goes through the reductive systems over through the local systems over the Borel subgroup, and it turns out that the important, the relevant functor here involves pulling through this diagram. So it involves some kind of push-pull again with respect to this diagram. All right, so this was only an example. Even in the case of SL2, I have other types of Fourier coefficients which correspond to the fact that, you know, I could consider extensions between arbitrary two-line bundles. I didn't have to choose specifically omega and O. So that's what this category of Fourier coefficients is supposed to be, somehow the collection of all of those coefficients put together. And the important thing to keep in mind is that they still come in two significantly different flavors. There's the non-degenerate one and there's the degenerate one. So this category of Fourier coefficients, if you like, you can take any Fourier coefficient and restrict it separately to non-degenerate and to the degenerate part. So there's the non-degenerate, and this is what non-extended Whittaker coefficients would be like. So this is Whittaker coefficients. And there are degenerate, which are sometimes called constant terms, or constant term, I don't know whether to treat the collection of all of them as a single object or as many objects. So, and again, as you can see in this example, the compatibility conditions look very different for, they will be very different for non-degenerate and for the degenerate case. So, roughly speaking, Yes, I do. So roughly speaking, the Galois counterpart of this diagram looks as follows. So let me just, I'm not going to write anything here, please. But I want to say that the stuff about non-degenerate part of the Whittaker coefficients has to do with quasi-coherent sheaves on local systems, while this degenerate constant terms, they have to do with, roughly speaking, quasi-coherent sheaves also on local systems, but for a torus.
I should think about this being together with the situ embedding, the regular situ embedding.
Together with what?
So this is somehow the thing that commutes with the regular situ embedding.
Mm-hmm. Like which embed, like, oh, this map?
No, the one, the right, the piece on the right. These are local systems which commute to the regular situ.
Right. Well, but the point is that I'm not thinking of that. So I don't never embed the torus into G. It's always, rather, it's local systems that admit some kind of, it doesn't, so the correspondence between the two involves local systems that are just extensions of rank one things, just upper triangular. They don't have to be actually to be diagonal. Is that, I mean, is that the question or am I?
Not sure.
Okay. All right, but let me just say that, I mean, one big thing in the, somehow an important part in formulation and also in, I guess, in the strategy for proving this conjecture, is that we want to make this normalization to actually, we wanted to determine the, determine the correspondence uniquely. And for this, we need to know that a function can be reconstructed from its Fourier coefficient. So we need to know that this map has to be an embedding of categories, has to be fully faithful. And this can be achieved, well, at least in case of GLN. So this is an embedding for, well, it's easy when G is GL2. So easy, this is theorem when G is GLN. And it's more complicated for arbitrary G. But in order to have this, you have to follow this fusion strategy. So you have to consider not just individual, sub-bundles, not just line bundles in a sub-bundle, but you should see what happens when this line bundle degenerates, acquires zeros or something like this. So this is one subtle point. And then the other subtle point is that even if I do this, I still cannot treat these two separately. Because this is like trying to reconstruct, well, it's okay to reconstruct a function from its restriction to one set and its complement, but it's not okay to reconstruct a sheaf like this. So I want to say that there are somehow two kinds of gluing necessary in this construction. One is, so there are two kinds of gluing. There's some kind of fusion and dependence on points. There's something, some kind of run space construction involved that is necessary to make this an embedding. And there is a, in some sense, simpler kind of gluing related to extra data that's necessary to reconstruct Fourier coefficient from data of non-degenerate and degenerate ones separately. And by the way, this is a picture for SL2. For other groups, there will be more. There will be partly degenerate things somewhere in the middle. And so, so the big kind of part of the story is that this gluing can be accomplished this gluing can be accomplished on the right-hand side as well, although at first it's very, it's not at all clear how something like this, well, it doesn't actually glue to this, that's why the roughly word here. So how can it be glued to some version of this category? So this two categories can be glued together, and then it can be proved, and this is, so it can be proved for any group G that the corresponding map is an embedding. And then the strategy for the proof, which at least in case of GL2 seems to generally, well, seems to like it should work, is to, well, first to make this picture precise, and then to somehow generate enough, to write enough generators in both categories that are supposed to match. And I don't have time, obviously, to discuss this because I have minus 4 minutes. So let me just finish this sentence. So I can generate enough objects on both sides and then use this embedding to match their corresponding non-degenerate plus degenerate plus gluing data information. And that will guarantee that the corresponding categories, well, that the corresponding objects actually match. All right. I hope that made at least some sense. Won't let me go.
What about geometric line dance?
Yes.
Is there a strategy of proof that works in a similar way?
I mean, let me just say, I wanted to say something about quantum, but didn't. Now I have an excuse. So let me say that one good thing is that if the twist is not rational, then you don't have to worry about degeneracy at all. So in some sense, and so in some sense, life is simpler in the quantum case. And I want to say that yes, that this is, in fact, in some sense, this is the strategy. But maybe Dennis should have some other ideas. OK, Dennis is happy with me. Yes?
Well, just a naive question to confirm that my picture was correct. So you stressed the analogy with the Fourier transform. Mm-hmm. So this degenerate case, or I mean, the standard case, I'm taking a function, multiplying with exponential, integrate.
Yes.
So then would the degenerate case correspond to the case where I multiply with a 1, yes?
Yes. Yes, so that's, it's gone now. Too bad. But yes, this one corresponds to, so in the case of where you have a Fourier transform in one dimension, because of homogeneity, you can just either multiply by just usual exponential function or by 1, and that's the difference between these two.
Maybe just
mm-hmm.
follow up on that. So you had this example with the description, which was using the description of a bundle in terms of an extension.
Yes.
So I mean, could you expand this into some more general family or larger class of examples where you then represent an arbitrary G bundle or a sort of GL2 bundle as the extension, and then you would have the actual integration basically over the space of extensions representing this.
Absolutely. So for GL2, this is exactly what this higher, harder, so to say, Fourier coefficients look like. So this category would involve not just this simple extension of O by O, omega, but extensions between any two line bundles. And somehow, somehow the idea is that those are, what I'm trying to say is that this, there's also a reason to focus on the first Fourier coefficient only because of this extra data of the action of a big algebra. So somehow there's a classical result that if you know how the Hecke operator act on something and you know its first Fourier coefficient, then you know the rest of them by some explicit formula. So somehow this compatibility tells you, gives you some compatibility on the Fourier coefficients here and here, at least on non-degenerate Fourier coefficients. I mean, I can be more precise, but probably not right now. Any other questions? Thank you.